call off your names for me if you would. I see John.
Yeah.
All right. How you doing, John?
Good, how are you?
How's your family?
Oh, yeah, they said say hi.
Oh, good. You tell them I said hi.
All right. Christopher? Okay. Start over there.
Seth.
Seth. Real loud, Seth. Okay.
Noah.
Okay.
Joshua.
Joshua.
Daniel.
Daniel. I know. Okay.
Nate.
Nate.
Gabe.
Gabe.
Philip.
Philip.
Seth.
Seth.
Joey.
Weston.
Weston.
Weston, this is not your first year. You were here last year, right? Mm-hmm. No? Okay, Weston.
Caleb.
Yeah.
Isaiah,
I can barely see you. This is my chef.
Logan.
Who?
Logan,
right. Yeah. Matthias? Yeah. Matthias, I appreciate your prayer. Yes, sir.
I'm Lucas.
Lucas.
Walker.
Walker.
Dallas.
Abraham.
Ben.
Yeah, Ben. Okay.
Noah.
And then back there, last two.
Grant.
Jack.
Jack.
I know you, right, Jack? I can't see you, but I think I see the shape of your.
You got it, soul.
Yeah, you're Jack. Okay.
Yeah.
I just want to make sure you do that. All right.
That's actually not what I want on screen, is it? Okay. All right. Let's see. That's not what I want on screen either. This is what I want on screen. All right.
This is going to be a good class. It's going to be real interesting. As you know, we'll probably need to rotate this just a little bit. As you know, if you paid attention to what you signed up for, in this class, we are going to be studying. Well, I messed up that now. Turn it back to where it was, I guess, would just be easiest rather than trying to mess it all up. That's good. You're good. We're going to be studying in this class that great restoration preacher named Warren Peace. Warren Peace is said to baptize over 1,200 people and establish 43 congregations. He was born in 1798. He was born in Northeast Ohio area known as the Western Reserve. Married Olivia Newton John. Settled on a farm near the present LaGrange, Kentucky, where he raised ostriches. And he raised 13 sons, three of whom became the 17th, 18th, and 19th presidents of the United States. And he had one daughter who played Buttercup in The Princess Bride. Oh, I'm mad I heard somebody laugh. You don't believe that, do you? Is that what you signed up for? What did you sign up for?
War and peace.
That's what it says, doesn't
war
it?
War and peace.
Oh, war and peace. All right, so that's what we're going to talk about. This is going to be the kind of study where I want you to feel free to speak up if you have questions. Matthias, one of the things I appreciate about your prayer, you said something about if we have questions, ask them. And I think we're just talking about in the classes, right? Or what? But in this class, if you have questions, I want you to speak up. And some of you will disagree with some of the things that I say. And I want you to feel confident that you can speak up and say, you know, I'm not sure that's right. Here's this passage or here's this point. Okay, can you do that? You think you can disagree with me? Do you? All right, then tell me you can't disagree with me because I'm saying you can disagree with me. Can you disagree with me? Well, that's not disagreeing with me. I believe you can disagree with me. All right. I do want you to feel free. This is going to be kind of open-ended. I have a view, and I'm going to try to convince you of the view that I have by the time the week is over. And I think it's important. I think that the question of whether or not we can go to war, whether or not we can serve our country and take a life in the service of our country, is a question that really boils down to one of the most fundamental teachings of the Word of God. So I think it's important. But it's also something that I would suspect if I took a poll, I wouldn't be surprised that most of you have a different view than I do if you've thought about it. Some of you haven't thought about it. Raise your hand if this is something you've never really thought about one way or the other. Raise your hand. Okay? Raise your hand if you have a pretty clear view in your head what you think the Bible teaches on this subject. Okay. All right. Good. So, there'll be plenty of room for discussion. But I want to begin with a couple of passages in the Old Testament.
And I want to go to, that's not what I want. Ah, sure it is. I want to go to Deuteronomy chapter 19. Oh, hang on, before we do that. What are some reasons that you might bring forward as evidence that the Bible would teach it is appropriate for God's people to go to war? What are some reasons that you could think of? Even if it's not one that necessarily you believe, but you've heard it argued, or maybe one you believe. What would you think? Yes, sir.
God sent people to Jerusalem all the time to take them into captivity, or they took Jerusalem to Babylon to destroy that city.
Okay, all right. So basically some of the wars that we read about in the Old Testament, right? Is that kind of what you're summing up?
Yeah.
Man, that's our topic tonight. That is our topic tonight. How do you like that? Okay, what's another one? Yes, sir.
There were New Testament Christians who served in the Roman military.
And a prime example would be?
Cornelius.
So, and we're going to talk about Cornelius. That'll be a little bit later in the week. Who's got another one?
The Judges, they took over Jericho.
Not Judges. You're close. Joshua. And that kind of comes, tell me your name again.
Me?
Yeah.
Philip.
And your name again?
Walker.
So Walker, you're kind of making a reference to the same point I think that Philip was. The idea that we have good examples of Israelites going to war in the Old Testament, like when they conquered Jericho. We're going to look at Jericho in just a minute. Yes, sir?
Ben read from Romans 13, and we're to obey the governing authorities.
I often hear that argument made. You know, from Romans 13th chapter, we're supposed to obey the government. And sometimes in a country, there's a draft, and the government says, you're going to go and you're going to fight. I'll tell you a funny story. I had heard this story years ago, but I was reminded of it. Did any of you all know the name Harold Valley? No? Any of y'all know the name of Ed Harold? You do? Yeah, some of you. I was talking to Ed's wife the other night. She was reminding Dee Dee, and she was reminding me of this story. Harold Valley did not believe that he could go and fight in the war and kill anybody. But he got drafted, and they wouldn't give him a choice. And they put him in a combat role. So you know what he did? He just refused to load his gun. He went into battle with an unloaded gun. And you know what happened? There were a bunch of Germans who wanted to surrender. And they saw him, and he had a gun, so they surrendered to him. So he captured a bunch of Germans with an unloaded gun. I think that's a hilarious story. Anyway, all right, so we've got three arguments that have been brought forward so far. The idea of the Old Testament wars, the idea of somebody like Cornelius, who was a centurion, in the Roman army, and at Romans chapter 13, which says you have to obey the government. Anything else? Yes, sir?
Ezekiel 33 talks about the watchman and how his duty is to warn the people of an impending attack so that they can defend themselves and not just, you know.
So the implication is they're going to defend themselves.
Right.
Yeah, which comes right back to the point that Philip was making and the point that Walter was making, that we have these Old Testament accounts of wars that the Israelites fought. You got to prove those wars. This is easy. We won't even disagree about this. Yeah, obviously. God commanded. All right. Anything else? Yes, sir?
I would say that, like, in the New Testament, it talks about becoming a servant. And, like, you're serving your country. So you're serving the people in the country. And just kind of, you know, just the Bible says to be a servant.
So you need to be a servant. So here, this is something my country needs, yeah. So I can serve my country. Okay. I actually don't have that. Yeah.
Well, and Paul talks about being a soldier, and it uses a lot of soldier metaphors.
That's one we are going to talk about. There's just a whole lot of symbolism in the Bible about war, and Paul uses it, and we'll talk about some of that. That'll be later on in our study. But tonight, what we're going to do is we're going to talk about the point that Philip brought up, and the point that Ben Walker brought up, and the point that Seth, you were the one. Yeah. Okay, if I could get some help here, pass these out. These are some handouts. You can take one and then come help me pass them out.
They are, you can keep them in this form, or you can take them out of these swim covers and stick them in your folder, if you have copies in your folder, if you'd like. Kind of be careful when you grab them, because they tend to come apart. Can you take those and hand those out? Take those and hand those out, Jack. All right. And that may be enough. That may be enough. There we go. That's probably going to be enough. I think we've got enough for one out there. We'll get to that in a minute. That's an article written by J.W. McGarvey back in, I think, 1868. And it's an article that's very hard to read. In the 1800s, people wrote, in a difficult way to read. And so what you'll find is the article, I'm not going to ask you to read that article. I doubt that if you try to read that article, you get very far in it. I suspect most of you, if you get to the first page, you've got, what is this? I can't read this. That's kind of a challenge. You know, I figure some of you are going to try to prove me wrong. That'd be all right. But if you turn to the last four pages, the last two sheets of paper, you'll see there's a summary of his article. And we're going to go through that. First of all, let's turn to Deuteronomy, the 19th chapter. And I need my Bible. Deuteronomy, the 19th chapter. Now, when I say turn to Deuteronomy, the 19th chapter, is this an opportunity for you to disagree with me?
No.
No, you turn to Deuteronomy, the 19th chapter. All right. Let's go to Deuteronomy, the 19th chapter. And I may save a little time. We'll start. Yeah, let's get the first part of Deuteronomy 19 anyway. The first three verses is what I have on my notes here. When the Lord your God cuts off the nations. Is everybody with me? Everybody with me? When the Lord your God cuts off the nations, whose land the Lord God gives you, and you do what? Dispossess them. And settle where?
In their cities.
And?
In their houses.
In their houses. You're going to go dispossess them, and you're going to settle in their cities, and you're going to settle in their houses. You shall set aside three cities for yourself in the midst of your land, which the Lord your God gives you to possess. You shall prepare the roads for yourself and divide into three parts, and he goes on. He talks about some provisions that would be made for the avenger of blood. So what do you notice in verse 1? Anybody, anything jump out at you?
They were rebellious.
Who was rebellious? Not sure I see any rebellion there. What do you see?
Okay, so what was in my mind is that God's the one cutting off the nations.
God's the one cutting off the nations. That's right. That's going to be an important point. What else? They're going to go in and they're going to dispossess the people of the land. What does dispossess mean? Yeah.
To take something from someone?
They're going
to
take it from them. What are they going to take from them?
Their city and their houses. And
yeah. And then what are they going to do?
They're going to they're going to live in their houses.
They're going to live in their houses. That's right. Okay. All right. Now come to Deuteronomy 20. Deuteronomy 20, it says, when you go out to battle against your enemies and see horses and chariots and people more numerous than you, do not be afraid of them. For the Lord your God who brought you up from the land of Egypt is with you. Now it shall come about that when you are approaching the battle, the priest shall come near and speak to the people, and he shall say to them, Hear, O Israel, you are approaching the battle against your enemies today. Do not be faint-hearted, do not be afraid or panic or tremble before them, for the Lord your God is the one who goes with you to fight for you against your enemies to save you. And then let's skip on down and let's come to verse 10. Now, by the way, this is the book of Deuteronomy. So, in a timeline of the Bible, where does this take place? So let me narrow it down for you. How many years were the Israelites in the wilderness?
40 years.
In that 40-year span, where does the book of Deuteronomy fit? Where does the book of Exodus fit in that 40-year span? The beginning. That's right.
And the book of Leviticus is while they're still at Mount Sinai. Where's the Numbers fit? Numbers covers the whole 40 years pretty much. Where's the book of Deuteronomy fit? Right at the end, just what did you start saying?
Right before they
go into the promised land. So here they are, just outside the promised land. They haven't crossed the Jordan River yet. They've not conquered Jericho yet. And God is telling them, all right, you're about to go into the land. Here's how you're going to do it. So let's start in verse 10. When you approach a city to fight against it, you shall offer it terms of peace. You think that's nice? What does that mean, offer it terms of peace? Huh?
You can surrender.
You can surrender and live. That's what you assume that would mean. And it shall come about, if it agrees to make peace with you and opens to you, then it shall be that all the people who are found in it shall become your forced labor and shall serve. So they'll kill them, they just make them slaves. However, if it does not make peace with you, but makes war against you, then you shall besiege. What does besiege mean?
Surround it and not let anything in or out.
Why would you not let anything in or out?
Because they die.
Yeah, they'll starve. They'll get weak. They'll probably get sick. And they can't get out to get to their crops, to their fields. And so pretty soon they either give up or they're so weak you can just go rushing in and you can take the city. Verse 13. When the Lord your God gives it into your hand, you shall strike all the men in it with the edge of the sword. Only the women and the children and the animals and all that is in the city, all its spoil, you shall take as booty for yourselves. So kill the men, take their wives for yourselves. Right? And then it says in verse 15, thus you shall do to all the cities that are very far from you, which are not of the cities of these nations nearby. So everything we've just talked about is not about the cities like Jericho. It's not about the cities right there in the land of Canaan. Now we're going to find out what he says to do about the cities right in the land of Canaan. So let's start reading in verse 16. Only in the cities of these peoples that the Lord your God is giving you as an inheritance, you shall not leave alive what?
Anything that breathes.
So would they kill the men?
Yeah.
Would they kill the women?
Mm-hmm.
Would they kill the children?
Yes.
And kill them all. But you shall utterly destroy them, the Hittite, the Amorite, the Canaanite, the Perizzite, the Hivite, the Jebusite, as the Lord has commanded you, in order that they may not teach you to do according to their detestable things, which they have done to their gods, so that you would sin against the Lord your God. So, there's a couple of reasons God wants them to kill these people. One is what?
They're wicked.
They're wicked. And God doesn't want those people to influence his people. So it's really a war motivated by a desire to eradicate a false religion. Is that a fair statement? Anybody disagree with that statement? Would you say that's what it is, a war designed to do? And the other thing that it was designed to do was to drive those people out so that the Israelites could get
the land
and their houses and all of that. All right? You mentioned Jericho a little bit ago. Yep, that was you, Walker? All right. I can learn your name. Turn over to the book of Joshua. Joshua, chapter 6 and verse 21. We are going to use this projector here in a few minutes, maybe. I had these guys go all trouble to set it up. We ought to use it for more than just War and Peace. How many of you were fooled by that? How many of you thought we were going to study about the Great Restoration preacher, War and Peace? Just somebody raise your hand.
Until the ostriches part came out, I was like, it was until the president's part.
Until the president, okay. Alright, okay. Let's go to Joshua chapter 6 and verse 21. So Jericho is the very first city the Israelites come to conquer, right? Alright. So in Joshua chapter 6, the very first city in the land, in verse 21, somebody read that verse for me.
They utterly destroyed everything in the city, both man and woman, young and old, and ox and sheep and donkey, with the edge of the sword.
Yeah, so they killed every man, every woman. Did they leave the young people alive?
No.
Now, they killed the old people, the young people, and even the animals. Who was spared?
Rahab
and her household, right. Everybody else was killed. All right, so that's some background we want to think about. Now, this article that I've handed to you is an article by J.W. McGarvey, and he's going to be asking the question, can we look at, this is the point that was mentioned by three of you, and it's a point that's often made, and that's why J.W. McGarvey wrote, anybody ever heard of J.W. McGarvey? No. You did, okay. J.W. McGarvey was a preacher of the gospel back in the 1800s. And so he wrote this article, and if you'll look at the top of the second or third page, you'll see the title. Somehow I dropped the title off of the front page. But what's the title of the article? You see it? It's up at the top.
Jewish Wars as Precedent for Modern Wars.
Yeah, Jewish Wars as Precedent for Modern Wars. What does precedent mean?
Proceeded, like it came before, and it'll like be a learning.
Yeah, right, exactly. They had Jewish wars, and we're asking, can we have wars today? And the argument is often made, well, the Jewish wars are a precedent. You had these wars, were they approved of by God? Yeah. And so the question is, well, can I look at that and say, that's a precedent? That means that we could fight wars today. That is what his article is about. That's the question. Now, before we get into this, is this, if we get the answer to this question, and it's yes, then maybe that settles the whole thing. If we get the answer to this question and it's no, Jewish wars don't serve as a precedent, then does that mean there's no reason to justify going to war? Just means that that's not a good reason, right? Do you understand what I'm saying? So he's not answering, he really does in a way, but we're going to approach this. He's not trying to answer the whole question about whether or not a Christian can ever go to war. He's just tackling at first, he's just tackling this question. Can I show that it's all right to go to war by looking at the Jewish wars? Can somebody else say that better than I said it? That's right. Do the Jewish wars justify our actions? And if the answer is no, maybe there would be something else that would justify them, possibly. Because we had several different arguments that were made. We had the Cornelius example that was made. We had the Romans 13 example that was made. So we have to look at all those. But right now, we're just going to ask the question, do we look at the Jewish wars and say that answers the question? Yes, Philip.
If we say that the Jewish wars do not answer it, and we say that's just it, think about the Holocaust, if we just let that happen, if no one went into war to stop that, I mean, millions died already. Think how many more would have died.
So that's the case of saying, here's a conclusion that seems horrid, and I don't like that conclusion, and so that kind of leads us to prejudge the question at hand. We will come back to that question a little bit later on, okay? All right. Yes, sir.
About that question, do you want to like answer?
Go for it.
Yeah, I'd say no, because it's completely different, because God wanted the purging of false gods, and as they say, he's jealous or zealous, some might say. So we're not destroying false gods today, so.
Okay, so tell me your name again.
I'm Lucas.
Lucas, all right, Lucas, we're going to get to that point in just a second, and you may get a chance to restate this. Yes, sir, Jack.
Back in that time, during Deuteronomy and Joshua, their authority came from God, and what God said they needed to do, and if God told them to go to war, I think that was right for them to do so. During our time, we have a government that God appointed. I wonder if that somehow is different.
Is your last name McGarvey?
No.
That's kind of the point McGarvey ends up making. But let's go through it here. So he goes through his article. And this is my summary. This is kind of what you see in the last two pages of your handout. He says, okay, let's take a look at this argument from the wars. Can you all see that? Can everybody see that? Do I need to focus that anymore? It says Israel. There's a syllogism. You guys know what a syllogism is? What's a syllogism, Micaiah? Am I saying your name right?
Yeah, that's right.
All right. So it's like we have two premises that logically lead to a conclusion.
Major and a minor premise and conclusion. You want to make up a syllogism?
Sure. So you could say that.
I'll give you a minute. All right. Anybody? I count to 10 silently and see who the first one who can create a syllogism is. And Mackay is going to be working on one. Okay, I'm going to count to 10 silently. Okay, anybody got one? Nobody got a syllogism?
So you can say, like, all pillows are soft, all soft things are comfortable, so all pillows are comfortable.
There you go. That's a syllogism. All pillows are soft, all soft things are comfortable, so all pillows are comfortable. So, and whether that's valid or not depends on whether or not it's true that all pillows are soft and whether or not all soft things are comfortable. Are all pillows soft? Jacob was in Genesis 28. The sun was going down, and what did he get for a pillow? Was it soft? So then we've already, the major premise in that is false. So the conclusion is not sustained in that you can't get the conclusion out of it. All right, so here's a syllogism. God cannot sanction that which is morally wrong. What does sanction mean? Make it okay, allow, approve. God cannot approve what is morally wrong. Here's a minor premise. God has sanctioned war. Is that true? Well, we just talked about a bunch of wars God sanctioned. And so then it would seem the conclusion would be war is not morally wrong. So God cannot sanction what is morally wrong. God has sanctioned war. Therefore, war is not morally wrong. Morally wrong. McGarvey is saying, here's the syllogism that is used to argue that Jewish wars are a precedent for today. You with me so far? But he's going to say, is that valid? That's what he's going to do in this article. And we'll walk through this. He argues this proves too much. If it's valid, it must be valid for the kinds of wars Israel fought with God's approval. This is bringing us back to you. What he's saying is, if we're going to say God sanctioned war and therefore it's not morally wrong, then you'd have to say the kind of war that God sanctioned is not morally wrong. That's obvious, right? Yes, sir. No.
Maybe going to this, wouldn't even that be too general? Because, I mean, it's not even just the kind of war, it's that specific.
I think you and Jack are both related to McGarvey. So those are points that McGarvey is going to make. Yes, good. Okay, Lucas, tell me your point again.
I don't agree with saying that modern day wars can happen because of the examples from the Old Testament. Simply because God commanded them to purge false idols because God hates a false god. So... No, I just don't really.
So in other words, another way to say it is, the wars that God approved of, the ones that we're going to be talking about here, were wars designed to eradicate false religion, to eradicate believers in idols and those kind of things from an area. So if we can use those wars as a precedent for today, then what kind of wars could we fight? We could fight a war to go eradicate whom?
Like the
Muslims? Muslims? Well, a terrorist is not a religion. Well, maybe it is. But we could use it. How about the Baptists? How about we all, get ourselves armed up and go down and attack the Baptists? You know? So that's the argument that he's going to make. He's going to say if it's valid, it would be valid for the same kind of war. A war designed to eradicate a certain religion. But he's going to say some other things too. He's going to say the war against the Canaanites... Was it a defensive war or an offensive war from the perspective of the Israelites?
Offense.
It was an offensive war. It was an offensive war. They were attacking people who had not attacked them. He's going to say they aimed to exterminate the native tribes, the people who already lived there. They came to seize and destroy their movable property, to take permanent possession of their country. They came to cultivate vineyards which they had not planted, and to dwell in houses they had not built. They're going to kill the people and live in their houses, right? So, McGarvin's point is, if we can say Jewish wars are a precedent for modern wars, then that would mean this kind of war is okay. And so we could attack a country so that we could get their houses and live in their houses, and we could get their land and exterminate all of them. All of them? Who could we exterminate? Men? Could we kill men? Could we kill women? Could we kill children? We could kill everybody. Do you see the logic of his rebuttal of this syllogism? All right. Well, he's going to go on. Now he's going to talk about King Saul. What was King Saul commanded to do? Utterly destroy who?
Everything. Every living thing.
The Amalekites. All of them. And what was Saul's mistake? What mistake did he make?
He left some livestock.
Kept alive livestock? Why did he say he was going to do that?
Because it was too good for just to kill it. And it was for the temple, right?
It was, we're going to sacrifice it to your God. See, people wanted to save this alive to sacrifice to your God. That was what he said. Well, the problem was he got rebuked because he did not carry out the command of God, which was to utterly destroy everything. He kept alive the best of the livestock, and he kept alive King Agag. Now, McGarvey's going to make the point that they spared neither age nor sex. They put the whole population to the sword. And then he's going to say, where is the Christian advocate of war? And I'm just taking phrases out of McGarvey, trying to catch the train of thought in his article here. He's going to say, where is the Christian advocate of war who's willing to abide this inevitable result of his own logic? So what he's asking is, do you know any Christians that would say that's the kind of war that would be all right to fight today? A war where we destroy every living person. Men, women, children. Do you know, would you ever feel comfortable with a war like that? But McGarvey's point is, if the Jewish wars are precedent for us today, then the kind of wars the Jews fought are the kind of wars we can fight today. The Jewish war of extermination against the Canaanites, this is quoting from McGarvey, was unprovoked. He says the cause was a desire on the part of the Jews to possess the land, and a determination on the part of Canaanites to repel an unprovoked invasion. So he's saying, first of all, the Israelites wanted the land. And the other piece of it was the Canaanites didn't want to give it up. Right? In other words, the Canaanites were fighting a what kind of war?
A defensive
war. Oftentimes, people will say today that because the Israelites fought wars, that means it'd be all right for us to fight wars. But the only kind of wars that would be just for us to fight would be a defensive war. Or a war like you mentioned, Philip, where we're trying to protect, say, the Jews and the Holocaust. But we wouldn't want to fight an offensive war. And McGarvey's pointing out, but the kind of wars that the Jews fought were offensive, and it was the Canaanites who were on the defense. Saul's war against the Amalekites. Did the Amalekites do anything to the Jews? This is a trick question. Did the Amalekites do anything to the Israelites?
They angered God.
Huh?
They angered God.
They angered God. When did they anger God?
Serving false idols.
Well, yes. All right. That's true. You're right about that. But did they ever do anything to the Israelites that angered God? Yes, sir.
They attacked the ancestors of the... Well, they attacked the Israelites like way before King Saul was king.
Way before. Does anybody remember the passage where the Amalekites fought against Israel? It's when they were still in the wilderness, yeah.
I don't remember verses.
Somebody said it?
In Exodus?
Exodus! Good. Way to go. Turn to Exodus chapter 17. Exodus
So it's in verse 6, and it says, Amalek came and fought against Israel at Rephidim. So this is the Israelites in the wilderness. This is early on. This is even before Mount Sinai. This is before Mount Sinai. And the Amalekites come to fight against Israel. And this is the passage where Moses has to do what for the Israelites to win?
Hold up
his hands. Have to hold up his hands. But he got tired doing that, so what happened?
Aaron
and Hur on either side held up his arms. And so as long as they did that, the Lord gave the Israelites victory over the Amalekites. And then somebody read verse 14 for me.
Then the Lord said to Moses, write this for a memorial in the book and recount it for the hearing of Joshua, that I will utterly blot out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven.
And then read verses 15 and 16. Go ahead, same reader, Noah.
And Moses built an altar and called its name, The Lord is my banner. For he said, because the Lord has sworn, the Lord will have war with Amalek from generation to generation.
All right. So God on this occasion said, I'm going to blot out Amalek. That is why hundreds of years later, how many hundreds of years later? They come out of Egypt about 1440, 45. Saul is king in the 1000s. So about 400 years later. 400 years later, God tells Saul, go utterly destroy the Amalekites. Well, their ancestors had done something to Israel, right? But were any of the people who had done something to Israel alive at that time?
No.
The people who were alive at that time, they hadn't done anything to Israel. But they're to be slaughtered, men, women, and children. Somebody looked like they had a hand up. Yes, sir. Did you have a hand up? Okay. All right. So what we have is the kind of wars the Jews fought, invade the territories of a neighboring nation, slaughter the inhabitants. Warning, sarcasm ahead, not my sarcasm. This is in McGarvey's article, and I'm going to quote him word for word. How unfortunate for the world's great warriors that this argument was not sooner discovered. It would have justified all the conquests of Alexander, Caesar, Tamerlane, Napoleon, and even the ravages of every savage chief who ever burned a peaceful village and slaughtered its inhabitants. It gives them all the sanction of divine approbation. There's some words in there that are big words, and there's a couple of names. There's one name. Anybody here know who Tamerlane was? Do you know who Tamerlane was?
Sure.
Do you know who Tamerlane was? John, do you know who Tamerlane was?
Yeah.
Who's a really smart history person?
Didn't he invade China?
I have no idea. I don't know who Tamerlane was. But I know who these other guys are. All right, that's a little sarcasm. And then a warning, extreme irony ahead. He says, condemning offensive war and declaring the innocence of defensive war. So that's what he's saying brethren sometimes do today. They say, well, it would be wrong to fight an offensive war. But it would be right to fight a defensive war. They go to the divinely sanctioned wars of the Jews for an example in proof. They want to look at the Jewish wars and say, here's proof. But when they do, when lo, they find their exemplars engaged in the very warfare which they condemn, meaning they find the Jews engaged in war, in offensive warfare, while the enemies of the Jews are waging the wars which they wish to justify. So what he's saying is, when we say, yes, we can use the Jewish wars as precedent, and that justifies us to fight an offensive war, but we should fight a defensive war. Well, the Jews were fighting offensive wars, and the Canaanites were the ones who were fighting defensive wars. And so I think he has something else to say here. He doesn't. Okay, I skipped it. Any questions up to this point? Any comments? All right. No people on earth ever waged more strictly defensive wars than did the Canaanites. They fought in defense of their country, their property, and the lives of their women and the children. On the other hand, the armies of Nebuchadnezzar invaded Judea and laid siege to Jerusalem itself, and yet Zedekiah the king was forbidden to resist. Tell me your name again.
Joey.
Joey, were you the one that mentioned the Babylonians? Somebody back here in this area mentioned the Babylonians. Somebody over here. Seth. Was it back there? You, right?
I mentioned Ezekiel.
You mentioned Ezekiel. Yes, all right. So Ezekiel and Jeremiah are contemporaries. Ezekiel is one of the Israelites who's carried away into Babylon. Nebuchadnezzar is the king of Babylon when Ezekiel is carried away. And he's king of Babylon. And the king of Israel at that time was Jehoiakim, or you may say Jehoiachin, Also known as Jeconiah. And anybody know his short name, his nickname?
Joey.
No, that's Joey over there. Kaniah. And Kaniah, or Jeconiah, or Jehoiakim, was replaced by whom in Israel, in Jerusalem? Anybody know?
Zedekiah.
Did you say that, Seth? Good for you. All right. So Zedekiah is put on the throne. Who put him on the throne? Nebuchadnezzar did. Is Zedekiah a descendant of David? Yes, he is. He's not really the rightful heir to the throne. He wouldn't be next in line. Would have been the son of Jehoiakim, but that's not going to happen. So Jehoiakim's uncle, Zedekiah, gets put on the throne. His name is Mattaniah, but he's changed to Zedekiah. So he is put on the throne by Nebuchadnezzar. So guess who he is he's responsible to, besides God? Nebuchadnezzar. But he didn't like that. So turn to Jeremiah, the 21st chapter. We go to the top of the hour, is that right?
Until 6 o'clock, 3 more minutes.
I'm going to sum this up for you. In Jeremiah, the 21st chapter, Zedekiah is going to receive messengers from other area kingdoms who have also been subjugated by Nebuchadnezzar. And he is apparently cooking up a plot, a conspiracy, for all of these countries that have been conquered by Babylon to rebel against Nebuchadnezzar, to fight Nebuchadnezzar. And the prophet says to Zedekiah, don't do it. The prophet says, you're going to have to be subject. It's God's will that you be subject to Nebuchadnezzar. Now, if Zedekiah had fought, he would have been fighting against a conquering king who had come in and subjugated Judah. He would have been fighting against an occupying force. So you could have seen that as a defensive war. And yet the prophet of God said, don't do it. So the point here is the Canaanites were fighting defensive wars. But the Israelites here, when they were going to, and they were wrong, but the Israelites, when they were going to fight a defensive war here, they were also wrong. God said, don't do it. So we have the Israelites fighting offensive wars, and that was okay. But in this instance, fighting a defensive war was not okay. So the point that Garvey makes is, so somebody who says offensive war is okay, defensive wars are not okay. Defensive wars are okay, offensive wars are not okay, because we can do what the Jews did. But that's not what the Jews did always. Now remember, McGarvey's point is this. He's not arguing, at least not yet, he's not arguing that war is never justified. Really, he never does argue that war is never justified. He's just arguing that whatever justification for war there might be is not just the fact that Israel fought wars. Because if that was enough to do it, then that's the kind of war we could fight. Do you get that point? Do you get that much? We kind of beat that pretty good tonight. I'm going to leave it at that. We'll pick this up in our next class. We'll work a little bit more on McGarvey's article, not too much more, and then we're going to move on. And what we're going to do is we're going to take a look at each of the arguments that have been mentioned tonight as evidence that we could fight wars, and there's some other ones you have not mentioned tonight that we're going to talk a little bit about. And we're going to try to come to a conclusion by the end of the week. What does the Bible teach about whether we fight wars? Okay, thank you all.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you, guys. You did a good job. Good.